This is Fresh Air. The website and app Pinterest is well established as a place where you can gather images from your computer or the web and pin them to virtual boards, each having its own theme. But Fresh Air's tech contributor, Alexis Madrigal, says Pinterest is more than just a digital scrapbook. He believes that Pinterest could become a legitimate competitor to Google when you're searching for something but don't know exactly what.
The Pinterest interface is simple. Just click a button, and any web page gets broken down into its constituent images. Any of those can be added to your own set of images, known on Pinterest as a board. Other people can find those boards and copy what they like, or simply search through all the photos on the site. Pinterest didn't take off among tech-loving men in California. Rather, it was young women away from the coasts who initially flocked to the site to plan everything from simple dinners to weddings. Now, it has tens of millions of users who have copied billions of pictures onto boards about everything from macrame to sports cars. Pinterest is mostly known as a place people go to find things to buy or make. The company likes to say that Pinterest is about planning your future. But it's also just about seeing visually a bunch of interesting stuff on a theme, all in one place. So there are boards for wedding planning and child rearing and men's linen suits, but also for kittens and model airplanes and mountains. Some boards are just a mood, like monumental or cute or adventurous. Despite this popularity, Pinterest has never attracted the same kind of press or adulation as the companies that grew up around the same time, businesses like Instagram, Uber, or even Dropbox. Pinterest just isn't seen as a hardcore technology company that will follow the path of Google and Facebook. To some people, it doesn't feel like a world-shaping product. It's just a digital scrapbook, people say. But internet companies are valuable in large part because of the kind of data that they possess. And Pinterest possesses some really, really interesting data. The first part of it is that they're a repository of things that people would like to have or do. They're a database of intentions. And that has got to be valuable to marketers and advertisers. But it goes deeper than that. What Pinterest has created, almost unintentionally, is a database of things in the world that matter to human beings. While Google crunches numbers to figure out what's relevant, Pinterest's human users define what is relevant for a given topic. And because of that, they could become a legitimate competitor to Google, the world's most valuable internet company. That idea crystallized for me when I saw a heavy Pinterest user playing with the service. She looked up nature photography, then started adding descriptors: winter, ocean, African. Each of these adjectives brought up an entirely different set of pictures, each with its own collection of moods and aesthetics. If what you're looking for is a thing or a type of thing out there in the world, Pinterest is more likely to serve it up to you than even Google. Frogs, sneakers, cloud formations, volcanoes, subway graffiti, footy pajamas. Google will deliver web pages about these things, but Pinterest will show you a photo of the thing itself, and increasingly, the opportunity to buy it, or get to it, or experience it. By letting people copy and label images, Pinterest created this rich database of persons, places, and things. And they're just beginning to use that data to help people find stuff. With a programming team that's largely been hired away from Google, Pinterest has begun offering what it calls guided search. Pinterest co-founder Evan Sharp told me that guided search helps you find things you didn't know you were looking for. If Google is great when you know exactly what you want, Pinterest can help you figure out what you want. As you search, Pinterest will suggest tags that you could add to help narrow your query. Search for hats on Pinterest, and you might get fedora or baseball or church lady as suggestions. The lesson here is that the simplest things we do on the internet, when you multiply them by millions of people, create troves of data that were just inconceivable at any other time in human history. And in many cases, the companies who possess the data we've created over the past 5 years are still learning exactly how to harness it to do new things, whether that's making more money for themselves or delivering you up exactly the hat or photograph that you were looking for.
Alexis Madrigal is a visiting scholar at Berkeley's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and he's the deputy editor of TheAtlantic.com, where he also oversees the Technology Channel. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Okay, Robert, it's time for the two of us to talk about a pervasive threat to our online privacy.
That's right. It's time to talk about cats. Millions and millions of cat photos have been uploaded to the internet.
Little cats.
Big cats.
Grumpy cats.
And those cat photos can reveal more than just how cute your cat is or how much time you have on your hands.
I was using Instagram like everybody and photographing, you know, my life.
That's Owen Mundy, an associate professor at Florida State University.
It never occurred to me that my phone was geotagging all the photographs with the location and including that information and uploading it.
That surprise drove Mundy to create the website, I Know Where Your Cat Lives. He took pictures publicly shared on photo sites like Instagram and Flickr, photos tagged with the word cat.
He then used the location data embedded in those pictures to place them on a Google map. And we should say he gathered a million of these cat photos. Well, every so often it's someone dressed in a cat suit.
So when you go to IKnowWhereYourCatLives.com, you never know what you're going to see. A different photo pops up every time you visit the site.
You get to see inside of other people's houses. You get to see their cats, and you get to see sometimes them holding their cats.
Mundy says he wants to raise awareness about online privacy and how much information we give up.
And if your cat pic appears on the site, you can remove it by changing the privacy settings on the original photo. Oddly, for a person who created a cat website, Mundy is not a cat person, but he's coming around.
I wasn't when I started. I'm about 50% of the way there now, actually. That's an outcome I didn't expect.
And one other surprise.
People have emailed Mundy not to get their cats taken off the map, but put on it.
Which goes to show you can't herd cats, but you can't herd cat owners either.
Online travel has been changing. More and more people are booking accommodations through Airbnb, the site where residents rent out rooms to travelers. Or they're using carpooling apps to get around while on vacation. It's been dubbed the sharing or share economy, and it can be a money saver in areas hard hit by economic crisis like Southern Europe. But in sunny Spain this summer, authorities are cracking down. Lauren Freire reports.
I've arrived in Barcelona at the height of the summertime tourist season, and I'm armed with the trendy tools of this share economy. I've rented a room in someone's house through the website Airbnb, and I've booked a ride there through the smartphone app Uber. And here comes my driver.
Lo siento, espera mucho porque está
mucho. Mi nombre es Shahraz, soy de Pakistán.
Shahraz Jalal is 25, born in Pakistan. His father moved the family to Barcelona during the construction boom, but then he lost his job. So Shahraz is now supporting the family, making up to $125 a day as a private taxi driver, linking up with passengers through Uber. Every morning at 6 a.m., I pick up tourists at the airport. It's great. They pay by credit card through their smartphones, and Uber pays me at the end of the month, he says. But the other taxi drivers, they get really mad. Taxi drivers across Europe have gone on strike this summer to protest Uber. They say it undercuts their business and want it outlawed. A popular car-sharing company in Spain, Blue Move, has had tires slashed in an apparent attack on the share economy.
Ayer, cuando me voy al aeropuerto, terminal uno, mi policía...
Shiraz says the police recently harassed and fined him. He's bringing the ticket to Uber's office. Taxi unions say ride-sharing is unsafe. But Vincent Rosso, the Spain director of another ride-share website in Europe called BlaBlaCar, says it's just the opposite.
And if you get jumped into a cab, you don't know the driver. But in our case, people that jump into a car know in advance who is going to be in the car. Their age, the preferences when they travel, they can see, check the biography.
Spain is the biggest destination for European tourists, the most visible place for this clash of old and new economies, a test case for how other countries might regulate these new tools. My Uber driver Shiraz drops me at my Airbnb place and heads off to get another fare.
This is beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. There is not that much light.
My Airbnb host is Esperanza Casas. She works long hours at a marketing company for about $1,000 a month. She'd never afford rent without her Airbnb income.
I need it completely. I mean, it's the only way we have to live like decently. We have no other ways.
But Spain's powerful hotel lobby is angry, and local authorities have just slapped Airbnb with a $40,000 fine for failing to list rentals with the tourism board. The Airbnb website could be blocked in Barcelona. Esperanza is nervous.
And a bit scared. The problem is that if they really don't allow this anymore, me and, I mean, a million of people couldn't afford the rent. So I think it will mess up even more the economy.
Patrick Torren of the Catalan Tourism Board says he has concerns about Airbnb, but that he's not in the pocket of the hotel lobby.
Our position in this case is not thinking about hotels. It's thinking about consumer rights. It's thinking about quality. It's thinking about the security of our destination.
Barcelona is one of Airbnb's top destinations, and the company is appealing the fine, says David Hantman, Airbnb's public policy director.
I think it's a real shame where you have a government that's so aggressive. You know, there are ways of protecting neighborhoods and protecting citizens and putting some restrictions on this activity that makes sense because people are still going to travel. The key is to figure out how to make sense of this amazing activity instead of just trying to enforce old rules that were designed for really a different time.
Airbnb and other companies are in talks with the Spanish government. Among the compromises, a new rule in Madrid that requires a 5-day minimum for Airbnb. Hotels get the shorter 1 to 2-day visits. David Cordova is a government relations expert at Madrid's IE Business School, who's been following this clash of new and old economies.
Como el crecimiento en muy pocos años es exponencial.
In a few short years, the growth of these platforms like Airbnb and Uber has been exponential, but it's also been disruptive, he says. Traditional vendors weren't prepared for it, and they've reacted harshly. The trick is to prevent that from paralyzing this new share economy. Among those eager to see what happens is Rosa Maria Sanchez, a 60-year-old Spanish widow I met in Barcelona.
Hola, Rosa.
Sí.
Hola,
soy Es mi trabajo principal. Porque, bueno, la empresa, el
Hosting Airbnb guests is Rosa Maria's main source of income since her husband died and she lost her admin job. And now, she says, she has friends around the world.
De Tasmania, han venido también otra pareja de Taiwán.
From Tasmania, Taiwan, Korea, she says. Right now my guests are from Montreal. Oh, and there were those two sisters from Azerbaijan. We exchange Christmas cards now, she says. The test for Spain is to harness that enthusiasm for the new share economy and work out what role hotels and taxis can still play. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Barcelona.
With each new conflict, there seems to be images of alleged human rights abuses posted on Facebook, Twitter, blogs, and websites where they can ricochet around the world. But how does a viewer know if they're real? This month, Amnesty International launched the Citizen Evidence Lab, a site to help users try to determine the veracity of those images. We're joined at our studios by the lab's founder, Christoph Kettle. Mr. Kettle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How does this work? Someone sees a video, and what do they do?
The website provides you very, very clear guidelines how to assess a video. There are a few very simple steps that every one of us can do in a few minutes to check, is this new footage, is this old footage, has this footage been used before, does it come maybe from a potentially completely different conflict at all?
Yeah. So even if the image is real, it could be something that happened 5 years ago or in a country 2,000 miles away.
Exactly. And what you just described is really the core problem. We don't see a lot of technically manipulated footage, but what we see a lot is that footage is shared from a different conflict or it has been used already a year before. So it's something that happened already a long time before.
What are some of the telltale signs people should look for? Some of the first questions they should ask might be a better way to put it.
So I think the first question people should ask, is this actually new footage? And there are some really easy steps that you can take to do that sort of work. So you can do what we call a reverse image search. So you see, has this image already been used before? Has this video already been used before somewhere on the internet? So that's one of the first things you do. But then it really comes down to three specific things. What is the source? Can you confirm the date? Can you confirm the location? And a lot of red flags that we look for. So for example, somebody uploads a new YouTube video on a completely new YouTube account that was created the day before, that might be a red flag that this account was just created to promote this specific video, which might be misinformation.
There's a famous picture of white phosphorus coming down in Gaza.
Yes. It's a really, really dramatic picture. That is a picture from January 2009. Mm-hmm. And somebody posted it in the context of the current conflict and claimed that this is what happened today. And in a very tense situation, as we see in between Hamas and Israel, posting this sort of material really can lead to a further escalation. So that's why it's really important to be able to very fast say, like, this is old footage. That doesn't, of course, diminish the actual human rights violation, but it's important to say right away, this is not what happened today.
What if somebody knows what it, which one of your algorithms they have to meet and decides to concoct something theatrically, mm-hmm. but make certain it has the right time stamp?
Yeah, so that's a great question, I think. So that's why I also wanted to build a resource that is online so we can adapt it. Because if you look at the other side, people adapt their tactics as well. I can give a very concrete example. Yeah. Somebody posted a picture of the conflict in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It was of a picture of a destroyed tank. But actually, it was a picture of a destroyed tank from the Georgia-Russia conflict in 2008. And they flipped the picture. Mm-hmm. So it was much more difficult to detect that. So that's something we have to integrate into our work. That's why it's important to have an online website where you can like expose these sort of tactics.
What do you hope the Citizens Evidence Lab can accomplish ultimately?
Mm-hmm. I think that's really the most important question that we have to discuss here. We want to document human rights violations and we have to have credible evidence. And the ultimate goal is to bring perpetrators to justice. So this sort of video footage and pictures give us a completely new level of detail. So you see specific military units, you see specific individual perpetrators. That will be crucial to ensure individual criminal justice, and that's the ultimate goal of our work.
Christoph Kettel is founder and editor of Amnesty International Citizens Evidence Lab. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Every day, it seems that more places are invaded by mobile devices. But the concert hall, surely that's the one place where it's completely unacceptable to pull out that iPhone, right? Well, no. Some concert venues have actually opened the door to mobile devices. On Friday night, at the open-air concert hall Wolf Trap in Virginia, a whole section was set up as a wireless hotspot during a performance of the opera Carmen. It was the first large-scale test of a new technology to deliver subtitles to the audience. I went along, iPad in hand, and for most of the first half, I couldn't get the subtitles to work. Greg and Judy Hamill had two iPhones and two iPads between them, and they didn't do any better.
Well, numbers don't matter, because it's not working very well even with the multiple devices. It's in and out, unreliable. So I guess we're a little disappointed.
Kim Whitman is the director of the Wolf Trap Opera. And when she stopped by our studio, I asked her to explain the larger aim of bringing new technology into the concert hall.
I think the larger aim, especially from the standpoint of those of us in the classical music industry, is to find a way to give texture and context to the things that we do so that it feels a bit more integrated into 21st century life and the kinds of tools and techniques that people are using in the rest of their lives.
I read that you had experimented with Google Glass. Was that one of the things that inspired you to try this?
All of this was the outcome of brainstorming that we had that was sort of precipitated by that technology and other technologies. I received an invitation to become an explorer. So I did get a pair of glass, and the ideas just started flowing from there.
Now, at the performance on Friday night, things were a little bit buggy. The signal would go out, and sometimes it wasn't quite synced up. What went wrong?
Well, I just received the tech specs, the tech report right now, and actually we were a bit of a victim of our own success. We didn't think we'd have almost 500 users, but we did. Mm-hmm. There were challenges, of course, in knowing which frequencies they were going to use and which band they were going to be on. There's a lot of other Wi-Fi happening there at the park. And we had assessed all of that and sort of knew what our sweet spot was. But the amount of usage pushed us a little beyond that. So we actually had to go down for about 10 minutes and then come back up and continue.
Now, I should say that there were people that I talked to who were most excited about it. And those are the people using the Google Glass,
yeah,
because they did have the same cutouts that those of us who are using the Wi-Fi devices did. But there was something about being able to watch the opera, not take their attention off the stage the whole time and have the titles there that was really great.
And that was the inspiration behind the whole thing. Of course, we wanted to expand the footprint a little bit and make it available as an experiment to other users, hence the mobile device integration. But really, Glass is the beginning of a technological development that will really make supertitles much less clunky and easier to integrate.
Now, a lot of people would say that, well, this is going to be disruptive. All those little screens glowing, it's going to take away from my experience enjoying the show.
Well, we did one thing going into that because we had the same question, the same concern. But the thing was, I was astonished. It was, 11 o'clock at night. It was completely dark out there in the lawn.
Yeah.
And I actually went up to the loge and looked down over. And because this format uses white text on a black screen, there's almost no screen bleed. So as you look down on the completely dark audience, I expected to see a lot of glow, and there just simply wasn't any.
Yeah, I couldn't see much. Yeah. And I have to say, I was more apt to be bothered by, people opening their bottles too loudly or talking to the person next to them than the screens.
Yeah, actually, yes.
I've heard of people wanting to use this technology in other ways beyond subtitles, things like feeding out information about what's going on the stage or even being able to show close-ups of soloists on the devices. What do you think of those sort of approaches?
I think the intention behind all of those kinds of things is a good one and a strong one, and the instinct is good. As with any new venture, you have to figure out how to use this so that the technology doesn't become the endpoint, but that it becomes a tool for something that is enhancing the main experience, which is, of course, the really powerful experience that you have with the music and the theater. So, yes, there are a lot of things that we're going to try. Some of them we're going to find out. Probably the distraction level might not be worth the added content.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we have to experiment with this, and I think it's a very healthy thing that we are.
Kim Whitman is the director of the Wolf Trap Opera. Kim, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Harrier jet combines the speed of a fighter plane with the maneuverability of a helicopter. These single-seater jets are known for their vertical takeoff and landing, ideal for close air support near the front lines. Designed by the British and now flown by the U.S. Marine Corps, Harriers have an accident-prone track record and are notoriously difficult to fly. But why not have one for your private collection? Yesterday, a 1976 Harrier sold at the Silverstone Auctions in England for the equivalent of nearly $180,000. The weapon systems are dismantled and the engine isn't fitted to the plane, but with a little work, it could fly again. If a civilian flying a Harrier sounds ridiculous, well, there's already a guy doing it.
Hi, my name is Art Knowles, and I'm a retired Marine Corps pilot.
Knowles says he's the only civilian in the world to privately own and fly a Harrier. He's got a history with these planes. The first time he sat in the cockpit of one was 35 years ago.
I had the great fortune to fly about 75 different type model series of airplanes, most of them pretty exciting, F-18, F-16, but my absolute favorite has and always will be the Harrier.
That's why Knowles bought one. Back in 2006, a Sea Harrier went up for sale in the UK. Like the Harrier from this weekend's auction, it had no weapon systems and it was no longer equipped to fly. But Knowles was determined to get it back in the air.
The FAA was on board. The bank was on board. He offered it up for sale, and I was the first one there with a checkbook.
As for what he paid for this rare 1979 Sea Harrier, Knowles won't say.
We shook hands on a deal and signed a one-page contract written in Sharpie, and I headed back to the United States.
Meanwhile, the plane was taken apart, loaded onto a ship, and sent to the U.S. Then Knowles and his crew painstakingly put it all back together. If you're wondering what a manual for a Harrier looks like...
It's about 400,000 pages.
Instructions on landing gear, gas turbine jet engine starters, wiring diagrams.
We started following the instructions step by step by step by step.
Finally, his plane was restored and airborne.
It can come to a complete stop in the air. It can back up. It can turn sideways.
Those big Rolls-Royce engines roar. It takes a lot of thrust to keep these planes hovering.
Well, it burns a little bit of gas. When we're in the hover, we're burning a gallon of fuel, jet fuel, every 2 seconds. 1,001, 1,002. That was a gallon of jet fuel right there.
Knowles now travels the country, taking his Sea Harrier to air shows like the Langley Air Show in Virginia.
How about that? He backed it up like a school bus. Art Knowles.
When we're at an air show, I love the opportunity to be able to share it with other people.
And now with another private collector buying a Harrier at this weekend's auction, Knowles is also willing to share his expertise. He says he's available to help get that Harrier back in the air, too.
There's no reason that a competent pilot who had been properly instructed and trained couldn't, with the right supervision, safely fly this airplane.
Retired Marine aviator Art Knowles, the pilot of his own private Harrier jump jet.